Hello, hello, and hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode, If Not Now, When. In today's show, I am super excited to welcome Rima join us today. Rima, he is a partner of KDT Venture, an early-stage frontier science investing, where she partnered with scientific founders to engineering the world at the molecular level. Since 2020, her investment to date spanned the field of material science, cell immunotherapy, cancer metabolism, surgical robotic. He currently on the board of Dimension, Cypress Materials, and Modulus Therapeutics. She studied biology and neuroscience at Brown University and earned her MD from University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. With that, my friend, I am so excited. Please join me to welcome Rima on the show. Amazing. Well, Rima, thank you and thank you for coming here. I am so excited to have you.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me to join.
So tell us, how does all the journey begin for you?
Sure. So my journey begins back in a small town in the U.S., Scranton, Pennsylvania. We ended up there when my father, who went to medical school in India, decided he wanted to move his family after getting married, well, really just him and my mom, to the States. And for a foreign-trained physician back then, really, the opportunities were in the more rural parts of the country for him to practice medicine. He was a gastroenterologist. And so eventually, my mom and he settled in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And that's where I was born. And so I grew up in a very, you know, I would say not very diverse town. But it was an incredible opportunity because the people I grew up with, while they didn't look like me, were really interested in learning about how and why I was different. And so that, and I think it shaped me a lot because, and when I say how and why I was different, you know, I had different color skin than a lot of the people that I grew up with. I went to a Catholic school, but I was Hindu myself. And so I grew up Hindu at home. But I learned about religion and Catholicism from kindergarten up until 12th grade. I went to, you know, Catholic school until 8th grade and then a Jesuit school until I graduated high school. And, you know, I ended up being a cantor in church and leading one of our, you know, very Christian-based retreats called Kairos in 12th grade. And so integrating how different people thought, how different religions guide belief systems, and being able to learn about religion from a vantage point where I didn't identify with the religion personally, but I could understand how different beliefs influence the way others think, was an incredible experience for me. And so I'm incredibly grateful for the people that I had the pleasure to grow up with because of how open and understanding and really open-minded everyone was that I got to grow up with. And I think being able to spend time thinking through how different religions and different perspectives guide beliefs and motivations, I think has gotten me to this point today where I've built a career that doesn't necessarily follow a traditional path, but it first for me, it's been rooted in what motivates me. How do I want to live my life, and how do I take pieces from different parts of an academic career or different even religious beliefs or different thought systems and create a life that I'm really happy with. And it's not easy, but it's kind of this unstructured path to get there. And so, I spend some time talking about my hometown for that reason. But so I graduated from high school and then went to Brown University for undergrad. And that's where I studied neuroscience and spent a lot of time focused on synthetic biology. I was on the iGEM team there. And, you know, up until the point of starting college, you know, I was anchored and my father was a physician. I saw a lot of impact I could have as a physician, and I planned to be pre-med and you know, go to medical school after college. And that was the goal of neuroscience and studying biology, right? Is the goal is to get to this path.
So you have a goal to become a physician just like your father.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. So that's where I, you know, I really focused on neuroscience as this field of study that is kind of the, how I think the final frontier of the human body. We still don't know how to study it. We certainly didn't. We knew less back when I was, you know, entering college. And I think there was this drive of, I want to be a physician like my father, but where can I carve out my own path in this context of studying the human body and understanding the human body and helping people with diseases that are affecting them that we don't know how to characterize yet today? And that's really what led me to neuroscience, to say, I think one day I want to be a neurologist, because it would allow me to balance exploring new frontier while also being able to impact people who are dealing with something that really only a physician can help them through. But it was the synthetic biology approach. So studying synthetic biology and being a part of the iGEM team, which stands for International Genetically Engineered Machines, the goal of which is we're a team of undergrads who are tasked with building some machine with biology. So using molecular genetics techniques to engineer a cell to solve a problem. That is the premise of iGEM. And what we ended up doing as one of the, it was the second iGEM team that Brown ever sponsored, was build a sensor for heavy metal water toxins in water. And the way we did it is we engineered E. coli bacteria to sense lead. This is, you know, kind of the proof of concept promoter, is a lead sensing promoter that we attached to a series of proteins that essentially would induce a pore in the surface of that bacterium and cause the cell to lyse open and break open. And when that lead caused the bacteria to lyse, all of the electrolytes inside of that bacteria increased the conductivity of the solution. Then we, you know, built essentially a conductivity probe that would measure the change in conductivity that would give you this Boolean yes or no response. Does the lead exist in the water sample? And so it was this first realization for me that biology isn't just to be studied. It isn't something that someone has figured out and my job is to learn it and then apply it to treating patients. I can build something with biology, and I can not only build something in the context of human health here, I can actually build something that can solve an environmental issue. And so there was this really broad aperture that was painted for me as being part of the iGEM team that stuck with me, even through finishing pre-med courses. You know, I applied to a number of medical schools. I ultimately went to UT Southwestern in Dallas, Texas, right after college. And, you know, the thing with medicine is it's a very one-track path. It's very easy to say, okay, what am I supposed to do next? And there are groups of people who will have the answer. Okay, you take your MCAT, and then you apply, and then you go to medical school, and then you get through first and second years, and then you start your rotations, you take your step one. It's very easy to kind of follow others' lead. But there was this itch in me as I started, you know, my first and second years of med school, where I'd want to spend more time studying elements of the physiology I was learning about, and wondered, okay, well, let's talk about lipoproteins, you know, like LDL and HDL. As I was studying it, I was thinking, okay, well, it seems like from the Dallas Heart Study, LDL seems to correlate to heart disease, HDL doesn't. Why? Is it that we're not measuring the right qualitative impact of HDL? Like, is it a problem with our measurements more so than the fact that HDL doesn't actually play a role in the pathophysiology of disease? And so that stuck with me, and this reminder that biology is something that's still to be studied and still something that we can build with and understand the world with stuck with me. And so I ended up taking some time off after my second year of medical school to I applied for a fellowship with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and was funded to essentially work on a project with Dr. Helen Hobbs, who is at UT Southwestern, who studied HDL, the pathophysiology, and studied, you know, she's one of the discoverers of PCSK9, which is a protein that is implicated in LDL metabolism and is now kind of the chassis of a really high impact drug in that space. And so I had this opportunity to say, how do we study lipoprotein metabolism and cholesterol flux in the body? And how do we actually develop tools to understand and characterize cholesterol flux in the body better? And so I got to apply a lot of the principles I learned from iGEM to creating a bioassay to study what I called a cholesterol accessibility in the human body, and discovered a pool of cholesterol on the surface of cells that we hadn't characterized before. And the way I did that is by building a tool that, you know, used an engineered bacterial toxin to be able to, and that bacterial toxin is called anthralysin O. The way it evolved from bacteria is it senses and binds cholesterol on the surface of human cells, and then the toxin oligomerizes, pokes a hole in the cell and kills it. And that's actually the toxic effect of this toxin. But the way it does that is by sensing cholesterol. And so there has to be accessible cholesterol for it to sense. And so I isolated the part of that toxin that binds to cholesterol, removed the parts that form the hole in the cell and kill it, and added a fluorescent tag. And, you know, that took about a year to optimize. But ultimately, we got it up and running to be able to essentially color and fluorescently label a unique pool of accessible cholesterol in cells. And
wow,
it kind of opened up this realization that not only do we not know much about the brain, which is something that kind of stuck with me from a young age, but there's a whole macromolecule we don't study very well, which is lipid. And that even someone like me, who's, you know, still in the middle of med school, can discover and characterize this new qualitative feature of lipids that, you know, is implicated in disease. And it's, you know, they're unique tools that we can create that help us understand that, and that I could do that. ultimately, so it was in the lab for 2 years. We published on the assay in a wonderful journal called eLife, and you know, had the honor of working with Randy Scheckman while I was an HHMI fellow, and they launched that journal while I was an HHMI fellow. And so it was really an honor to have that publication in that journal, because they really focus on how do we make science accessible to people, and not just in terms of how we price subscriptions, but also in terms of how do you write your science? How do you tell the story of your science in a way that makes it accessible and interesting and engaging to larger groups of people? And that's certainly something else that's stuck with me through my career, is that storytelling piece. Mm-hmm. Nothing matters if people can't understand the impact of what you've done.
Yes.
And that'll kind of tie into the, you know, where being an investor in biotech, I think is really part of the impact that I want to make in the space. But yeah, so I ended up finishing up medical school, still wanted to be a neurologist, but now with this added focus of how can I study the lipid compartment of the brain with greater precision? Because as much as we don't understand about the neurological space, if we can understand the lipid compartment of that space, which makes up, you know, almost 70% of our brain is lipid. You know, it's all the myelin sheaths. It's a huge component of the membranes of every cell. And there's a unique lipid metabolism in the brain that's separate from the rest of circulation because of the blood-brain barrier. We'd be able to unlock some interesting features of disease that would be relevant to treating them with greater precision. So I ended up doing my neurology residency at the University of Pennsylvania. I was drawn there particularly because of one of the collaborators of our lab, Dr. Dan Rader, who had actually developed this really interesting assay to study quality of HDL, high-density lipoproteins, as opposed to just quantity, and had realized that there is this qualitative impact of HDL that does contribute to cardiovascular disease. And so it really fit in line with what are we measuring to really understand disease, and how do we start to understand and develop those tools in the context of neurological disease? So started working with him early on. But, you know, a couple years into my residency, I made the decision to leave. And I'll give, you know, I'll of course give the reason why. One is I loved my job. I loved working with patients. As a physician, what I realized, though, is to be successful, you do need to spend most of your time with your patients, right? There's so many things that they need that isn't just understanding the pathophysiology of their disease. That's a small part of practicing medicine today. I mean, it's everything that people talk about around, you know, taking notes and having to take phone calls and ordering labs and all of the administrative parts that fill your day. But it's also, especially with the conditions that neurology patients often have that are chronic, it's a lot of guidance on, okay, well, we don't have a treatment for this disease, but how do I make sure you're linked in with the right physical therapists, with the right exercise routine, all of these things where to be a really great physician, and I've always tried to focus on what is the best use of my time to be great at what I'm doing today, what would I need to be doing? And is there time left to be doing the things that I want to do, which for me was really this drive to study disease, understand it to a point where we could create more precise tools to treat those diseases. And ultimately, as a physician, there's your job is to deliver the existing mm-hmm. toolkit.
You want to be on treatments. The front end.
Yes, exactly. It's delivering the existing toolkit to the best way possible to optimize your patient's life and quality of life. I wanted to be the person developing those toolkits. That toolkit, developing new tools to add to that toolkit.
That's such a brave realization.
I was lucky in that my husband at the time, we had gone to, you know, we met in college, went to medical school together. He started a company based out of his MD PhD at UT Southwestern. And so he started the company during his fourth year of medical school. We graduated together. Instead of doing residency, he focused on building the company.
Wow.
And, you know, he went through Y Combinator. He had an incredible group of seed investors fund the company at that stage. And so I was privy to this network and this ecosystem of innovation and building biotechnology that most physicians in my place didn't have access to. And I was able to see, you know, it wasn't just an academic path being in the lab or practicing medicine, but there's this world of biotech mm-hmm. that exists that's focused on building out those toolkits, building out the tools that you can offer patients. And if I hadn't had that lens, it would have been a really hard decision, because up until, you know, that point from the age of six, I wanted to be a doctor.
And wow.
So it's not that it was an easy decision, but I was lucky that I had this ability to take a step back, ask myself in 10 years, if I was continued on the path I was on as a practicing physician in residency, did I want to be doing the job of people who were 10 years ahead of me? Or did I want to be doing something different? And I was able to access a lot of mentors through my husband's network of investors who also were physicians in prior lives to really understand what did I need to continue learning from my current path as a physician versus would I want to jump onto a parallel path and learn in a different context how to build those tools, right? And there was this realization that what are those tools, right? They're drugs, they're devices, they're things that are actually used to treat patient disease. How do you build them? Well, you have to go from work that's done in lab to characterize, you know, a disease signaling cascade implicated in pathophysiology of disease. Then you have to understand what target protein in that cascade is most implicated in driving that pathophysiology. What is a drug we can develop, whether it's a small molecule, an antibody, a genetic medicine that would stop that protein from causing that disease? And then you have to develop that drug through preclinical development, phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials. That was a black box to me. How do you actually take a drug from bench side characterization of a target to mm-hmm. a patient?
Essentially, it's the other side of the technology. It's a business.
It's
how do we go to market?
That's right. That's right. And so what I ended up doing is I left residency to join a venture creation firm called the Fanon Innovation Studio in Houston, Texas, that really the core competency of a Fan Innovation Studio is to fulfill that black box, is to take really early stage assets from academia, bring them into our portfolio, and develop them using primarily grant funding,
mm-hmm.
To a point where you now have a investable product, which is a developed preclinical drug asset or mm-hmm. device that we can take into clinic and start to move into this process of validating and creating something that now a patient's life can be improved by. Right. And so it was an incredible training ground for me to really elucidate that black box and understand, if I want to make an impact in patients' lives, what are all the pieces that are involved in creating that technology that's going to truly at scale impact mm-hmm. a patient's life?
Speaking of that black box, I imagine today many, many other founders also have that thinking, wow, that's a big black box for me. So I'm curious, what would you speak to her or him who also, delicately alive in the biotech space and maybe not quite sure about commercialization process? What is maybe one or two things you wish you know before? Maybe one or two things that really struck out for you?
Sure. So I think it's easy to describe that side of the world as the business side of mm-hmm. of biotech, of research. And the fact is, once you make that mindset to say that I want to create something for patients, and you flip into thinking through, okay, how do I take this discovery I've made in the lab and make it into a product that will make it to clinic and actually help patients? You don't want to bring in someone who has a business background. It is your technology. It's really hard to separate the science from the business at that point. And what it really requires is just a mind frame shift of, what is my goal with this technology? Fundamentally, as a researcher, your goal is to create a set of data that nature or science is going to find compelling and present it in a way that other researchers present it, such that you can get to that publication. What it means to want to enter into that black box of commercialization is to say, I don't want to just create a story that's going to be compelling to publishers. I want to create something that's useful from this technology. What does that mean? What is, let's say, the set of experiments that I need to prove out that's going to say that this drug really is going to be effective in treating a particular condition? What is the gold standard animal model that pharma looks to say that if I were to show efficacy of my drug in that model, because other drugs that have been commercialized, their first set of experiments were in this model, and that's how they got the go-ahead to move from preclinical asset development to pre-IND work. How do I identify what is the next best set of experiments to do to validate my finding? And it's not business, right? Like, someone who just has a business background isn't going to know mm-hmm. how to think through that very well-designed experiment. It's still in your purview. And what it really, as a scientist, right, as a scientific technical founder, what it really requires is a shift in the goal of what do I want to accomplish with my technology? And you still have the power to be at the helm of directing that ship. So that's something I wish I knew, right? I think there's this idea of bringing in business, and there's a whole set of skills that I can't possibly know because I didn't study business. And while there is a place for a business background, understanding that transition of technology at an early stage in a lab to validating early on whether the technology will have commercial potential is still in your hands. And it's not something that you can outsource mm-hmm. to someone who has a, quote unquote, business background. It's something that you should still have a lot of control over. And it requires you to just think about what's your goal there. And so that was that's what I did at Vannon, right? I thought, I just had an MD, I had some research experience, but I was basically going to be learning constantly from others how to run the business of commercialization. And the fact was, my job was still experiments in the lab, was still designing, okay, what is an experiment that's going to show that this small molecule drug that we believe will be an interesting prodrug to treat pancreatic cancer, how do we show that it's going to perform better than drugs that have already entered phase one, phase two, right? Your goal is to create either a best-in-class drug or a first-in-class drug so you can actually ultimately help people who aren't being helped today, right? Or is there a population of patients with B-cell ALL that are refractory to existing drugs? And so there's actually a patient population that still needs help. And how do you take that understanding and say, what is the experiment I can do today with my, you know, very early hit compound that I think can help these patients? Mm-hmm. What is the experiment I can do today that's going to allow me to build towards creating mm-hmm. a drug for that patient population?
Yeah. Essentially, is how do you find the value proposition in the market, but also translate in the early stage with the right indicator so we know this is a better product in the market supporting the specific segment of a patient?
That's right, right? It still gets to this point of you want to create a product that people mm-hmm. need. But as a scientist, you're really the only one who's going to, as a scientist who's well-trained in experimental design, who understands your technology because you're the one who developed it in the lab, it's going to be your job to do the work to actually validate this quote-unquote product, right? And no one's going to be better suited to do it than you. And that is the job of commercializing science. It is still science. It's science with a shift in how you focus the goal of your experiments. And that's something that was really eye-opening for me, where it was I was doing the work of commercialization based on what I understood about how to do rigorous science. That's what I learned from med school.
How was that transition from being a physician now jumping into the frontier? You are in the lab, you are testing, you are figuring out the commercialization. How was that transition like for you, Rima?
It felt like I was in my element, finally, for the first time in a long time. And I realized this about myself. I call it hitting walls, where I hit a wall when I was in residency of there's dissonance between what I want to do and what I have to do to be good at what I'm doing at that time, right? So there's, again, to be really good at my job, I really had to spend time in my patients' charts. I had to figure out who is the right social worker who's going to be able to help this patient find all of the resources they need. I had to figure out what are the right agencies that exist that are nonprofits that are going to provide the services that my patient needs to get through, not just my patient, my patient's family needs to get through conditions like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is an incredibly rare, fast progressing disease with no cure, right? And so I was doing that job and I wanted to be good at it because my patients deserved that, but I wasn't fulfilled.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, it's what we talked about earlier. I wanted to be able to take a beat and say, what is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease? What do we understand about it today? What are the next set of, let's say, experiments or studies that we could do that's going to help us understand where it comes from, why there are so many, why, you know, I was at an academic center where people were referred. So we had a disproportionate number of rare diseases that I you know, really got exposed to as a physician. But really, I mean, there were two patients with CJD within a couple of months that I treated and not treated. I cared for. And I wanted to spend time understanding why. Mm-hmm. And there was a point at which I realized this was my wall. I needed to distance myself from being the physician so that I could allow myself the time to ask the question why, because if I tried to do it at the same time, I would be doing a disservice to my patients as well as a disservice to myself in terms of saying, you know, I think there's an impact I can make. And maybe it's not even, maybe it's self-righteous to think there's impact, right? It's what I want. Like, I want to spend this time asking these questions and spending time understanding more about the diseases I'm seeing. And beyond that, I want to create more tools that are going to allow these patients to, you know, have anything in the course of their treatment that isn't just kind of passing away over the course of 3 months. And so that transition for me to say, at least now having this time to explore the why of disease and, you know, be in the lab. And a lot of my job was also focused on writing grants. So we mostly funded early stage development of drugs at Fannin using SBIR grants or CBIR grants. And so what we'd really do, since we had a whole portfolio of early stage assets, we would write 6 or 7 grants per cycle. So you can submit grants 4 times a year, applications 4 times a year. And so we'd write full grants for a number of assets 4 times a year. And part of this is, okay, deconstructing what are the assets we have? What problems could they solve? Because there's a commercialization plan that you write as part of these grants. Mm-hmm. What problems could they solve in the context of disease? And how do you build the story to say what the data that exists mm-hmm. today and what's the next step in the data that's going to get us closer to saying this is a product, this is a tool in the toolkit that's going to help this set of patients that don't have any help right now. And I realized breaking down the problem that way and thinking about this context of commercialization, not as just a separate skill set, but as work that allowed me to keep 1 foot in something that I know how to do well, which is science, and 1 foot in understanding how to think about value proposition, how to think about patient markets and you know, build this relationship between patient need to patient market and explore and like market being, you know, this is how pharma thinks about, you know, the market for Alzheimer's disease. I mean, it's a massive patient need that we need to fill. We need to understand how to treat those patients better. The part of commercialization is you write that out as a market size. Like it's the number of patients, the, you know, cost of treatment of that group of patients today. That's a market size, right? But it's everything that I knew about Alzheimer's, but with a different phrase. It just described differently, which is going from patient need, unmet need, to a market. And so that was part of the learning, right? It was really reframing what I already knew into this context of commercialization of technology. And so it felt like I was learning something new and yet was on this path of focusing on what I get most excited about and the impact that ultimately I want to have with the MD. And that was always my goal.
That sounds amazing. So you love it. What's happened next from there?
Yeah. So while I was at Fannin, as I mentioned, a lot of our focus was on using grant funding to de-risk early stage technology. And while I have so much appreciation for the CBIR program and for all grant programs sponsored by the government, by foundations, I realized that for a lot of the technologies, as I was working through what problems could these solve, right? This small molecule prodrug, for example, there is a use case in pancreatic cancer. There's also a use case across a lot of different diseases, but I'm writing this grant specifically for pancreatic cancer, or I'm writing this grant specifically for, you know, the treatment of pain or for addiction, because I know how to construct this grant for the NCI or for NIAID, for the institution that, you know, is within the NIH. That's the institution which I'm writing the CBIR for. And the way you assign value to a very, very early stage technology, I actually at some point found to be somewhat limiting, right? Where understanding, again, I'll just go back to this prodrug construct, right? There's a small molecule that would only get activated in the context of a tumor microenvironment. That drug, yes, could be effective for pancreatic cancer, but if we understood this mechanism of activation in the context of a low pH tumor microenvironment, this drug could be effective across a number of diseases, right? Not just pancreatic cancer. And the problem is it's hard to get funding to validate this technology early stage without writing that full grant specifically to the NCI. And the NCI wants to see what indication you're going to be treating down the line, right? And focus on one disease. Anyway, so the focus here
I see what you're
saying. The funding structure wasn't necessarily amenable to high scale, early stage technology development.
You had to fit in that mold of specific different path to get to the funding.
That's right. And that's when I realized really the impact venture capital at the early stages of technology development, of company formation in the deep hard tech sciences can be, right? And this idea of if you had people with a technical background who understand that next set of experiments that need to be done to validate whether a, you know, therapeutic modality could be effective across a number of indications, and who are willing to be there at your side to define that value proposition along with, you know, a founder who's developed that technology and wants to see it come to a point of validation and commercialization and have an impact in the world. There's a really exciting partnership to be had there between a venture capitalist and a scientific founder. And so that's how I, you know, Kane McCleary, who is the founding partner at KDT, he's a physician by training as well, and started KDT back in 2017. That's really has been his primary focus, is, you know, started KDT based on funding the biological revolution, right? Going back to, you know, my synthetic biology days, we know we can build things with biology. Our ability to build things with biology is massively facilitated by the decreasing cost of sequencing. If we can sequence DNA, we understand the code of biology, and we can engineer it to do and solve problems as we need to. And where that sits in the context of early stage technology development is really important to think about in the context of therapeutics. How do we think about gene therapy? How do we think about antibody development and understand how we can engineer therapeutics in a way that allow us to treat a lot of conditions that we've been limited in treating today, right? How do we think about, let's say, the capsid of an AAV particle in gene therapy getting into the brain to actually treat a neurological condition that we know is driven by a mutation in a single gene? That solving that problem of delivery of that gene therapy into the brain can be solved by understanding how to engineer that capsid protein that allows then for delivery of that therapy into the brain, right? So that's just one example of saying, if you know, this is why I joined KDT, is to fund the underlying technology development with this focus on what are the real problems that need to be solved in healthcare. And, you know, I could talk about KDT's thesis around other verticals outside of healthcare as well. But really, this is what drove me into working with KDT, is being able to fund those early stage technologies, partner with scientific founders who are building things that will be that frame shift of how our world looks in terms of our ability to treat disease. Mm-hmm. That's when and how and why I joined KDT.
So how do you like that?
Well, it's incredible, right? So let's go back to that wall I hit as a resident, to say I want to be able to build out the toolkit that physicians can use to help their patients. There's a couple ways to do that, right? You can be in the lab and you know, work towards developing and discovering new disease pathways that can be drugged. You can work at a startup company. You can work at a company like Fanon Innovation Studio, working on de-risking certain elements of these early stage technologies. Venture is this opportunity to say, let me work with the smartest people who are going to be the best technologists to take a technology that's really challenging to develop. That's why these academic founders have spent decades mm-hmm. in lab characterizing these technologies. I can build a portfolio of the smartest people making the most impactful technology. And through my ability to give them capital, as well as partner with them, join their boards if needed, but just spend time with them defining what are the steps in their value proposition that are going to allow them to create a product that's going to make an impact in a patient's life, it's the perfect place to be for, you know, what I wanted to do with my MD, right? And what I really wanted to do as a physician, which is help build out a wider breadth of tools to treat patients with.
I'm so touched by that, Rima. You just have such a heart. You have such a love for technology, for the innovation, for bring that incredible magic to everyone's life and really made that cure possible. You have just such a love for that. It's just so beautiful to see.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. And, you know, it's one of those things where as a venture capitalist, my job is still to return capital to our LPs, right? And so there is a financial component that, again, is, you know, it's the one foot in something I know, which is the science, which, you know, after having worked at Fannin, it is understanding value proposition at different stages of technology development. I am now, you know, manager of an asset class for limited partners. And that's the foot in something that I've learned over the past 4 years. And
how was that treating you? How do you like that?
Well, I think it's an incredible part. It's an incredibly important part of this infrastructure of commercialization, of creating an impact with technology, right? Which is that there is a point at which capital needs to be made and needs to be returned. And to investors. And so when you ask how has that been for me, I mean, it's been a learning experience, and it's allowed me to continue to form my understanding of this full stack process of
the black box.
Commercializing technology and ultimately creating an impact with that technology. But
what is one biggest thing that surprised you or you wish all founders know?
Yes. No, this is incredibly important, right? It's this idea of while I'm there with you partnering on how to define your next set of experiments to continue to grow value in your company, I am not a founder with you, right? I am an investor and I have my own definition of success within the context of my job. And an investor-founder partnership only works if there's this understanding of what success needs to look like for me too. And it's this reminder of my job is to invest capital in a company. And I'm trusted to invest that capital in the right places and to help that company grow from the point of view of true value accretion, right? Which is, you know, if we invest in the seed round, there is an expectation that a Series A will be raised within 2 years, 2 to 3 years, and the value of that company will be more than it was at the time that we invested in the seed round. And if that's not happening, I can't keep my lights on as an investor, right? Where I have my own investors that are expecting certain milestones and KPIs for me to achieve in terms of their return on capital. And I think that's something that venture capital has become this idea of, you know, there's grant funding, there's venture capital for early stage technology development. It's not always the right form of capital for someone to be asking for based on the stage of the technology that that someone is seeking capital for, right?
So tell us who are the right fit, who is not.
The thing is, when you take that first dollar of money from a venture capitalist, the time clock starts of value accretion, right? And so it's really important to map out what is value in the context of biotechnology. So let's take, for example, drug development. Let's say you have, you know, identified a target that you believe will be really effective in treating Parkinson's disease, and it's something that others haven't identified before, and you've, you know, screened a library of compounds against this target and found a few that seem to modulate this target effectively. There is a path to saying, what is value accretion going to be over the next few years of development of this hit compound? You can say, I'm going to go from a hit compound through lead optimization and get to a lead compound within 2 years, and I need X amount of capital to do so. And if I look at comparable companies who have developed drugs in the neurological disease space, when they've developed a lead compound in this particular indication, they raised X amount of capital. Mm-hmm. And so there is a clear path to say that based on the money I'm asking venture capitalists for today, I know the work I need to do and what milestone I need to hit mm-hmm. to define a higher value of the company. And, you know, after lead compound, it's taking that through in vivo efficacy. And after that, it's going through pre-IND work. And there is a value of that company that correlates and corresponds to those milestones in the outside world. And there are comparables that you can pull in from mm-hmm. other companies that help you tell that story, mm-hmm. right? Take another, you know, so that's a good pitch for venture capitalists. And it is the right time to take money because you know what to do with that capital to some extent. I'm not saying that things don't change along the way. But then, you know, you take a counterexample of someone who's developed or discovered a new target that's implicated in Parkinson's, but they don't have any way to modulate it yet today. The value of your company isn't going to change from target discovery to having a hit compound very much, because the amount of risk that goes into going from hit to lead optimization is still so high mm-hmm. that it's a much more challenging path to say that I'm going to use your capital to take on the very high risk that maybe I'm not even going to find a small molecule that hits this intracellular target, right, with high precision, or an antibody that needs to hit this intracellular target, which is just hard to do. And the path to value accretion is much less defined. And there will be investors who will want to take that risk with you. But you'll have to realize that you're not going to be doing yourself favors if you can't understand what is the use of that capital that's going to accrue value mm-hmm. of the technology that you're developing and the company that you're developing. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, there is this balance of, do I actually focus on grant funding, collaborating mm-hmm. with an academic collaborator to get to this point of a hit compound. And it's just, you know, one example, and there's a lot of different ways to think about value, but I think the drug development playbook is the easiest one to think about value accretion of how you're going to use capital to actually grow the value of your company.
I think that's a great reminder to understand that, again, investors here are partnering with you, but also here to invest. So having the ROI is so important to articulate, especially in that early stage of the pitching process. And for other founders to understand the KPI that you are tracking, whether it's your own process or looking at competitors in the space and mapping that journey from where you are today, A to Z, and what that might look like, how much capital you need, but more importantly, what the return on investment with that capital you're leveraging for next XYZ years.
Yeah.
And I love that what you speak about, the moment you're taking that first dollar, the clock is ticking. There's an expectation baited in that capital you're receiving. I think that's so important to understand, versus a lot of founders today feel like, wow, I just on this amazing, like, you know, Crunchbase, look at me, I'm raising this much. Like, it's not about that moment of press or that fancy moment. It actually so much more work need to be done in that process to get to the next success milestone.
That's right. It's exactly right. And, you know, I say this and it sounds like I'm, you know, some vicious finance investor. I say this because I think this is the part that is easy to forget mm-hmm. when talking to an investor. And I hope that, you know, my founders don't think of this, you know, return on investment when they think of me. Yeah. Because my job, my goal, you know, we always say that, you know, we'll invest in a really early company. It's two co-founders and we join as employees 3, 4, and 5, right? Like we want to be there to help you build.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously capital is part of that.
Of
our network's a part of that. Our time in the research lab pushing liquid around is a part of that, because the job at that point is still really well-designed experiments. And access to the right molecules or the right assays that are going to allow you to really understand what it is you're creating in that moment, right? But the part that's easy to forget is you as a founder are going to do much better when you remember what success looks like mm-hmm. for all of the people on your team. So that's your, you know, everyone from your co-founder to your research associate to your investors, right? What does their success look like? And how does that, how do you ensure cohesion of the team based on making sure everyone's motivations are being listened to and appreciated and remembered? That's how you drive success.
Yeah. It's a great reminder.
I also, the last thing I'll say on that is, you mentioned that Crunchbase, you know, like the flash part of starting a company. And I think this happens a lot in pitches with really early stage founders, which is there's this idea of this technology, this is what we know today. If it works, it can change the world. Like, it can solve climate change. It can treat all people with Alzheimer's, right? And all of that is great. But the thing with technology-focused investors, especially at the early stage, is a lot of us have scientific backgrounds. We know how challenging it is to go from the breadcrumb of validation that you have today to saying that you're going to solve the world's biggest problems, right? And so I call that kind of phase four, take over the world. Like, yes, you have something that if works, can change the world. As a seed investor, my job is to underwrite phase one, right? What is phase one? How do you get from phase one to phase two? How are you thinking about all of the steps required to take your technology and the validation you have today and ultimately scale to solve a much bigger problem? Understanding that even defining the problem along the way is going to be part of your job. And so I want to understand how you're thinking about the problem you need to solve today in the context of that phase four, take over the world. And that's where we get really excited. Okay, what are you going to do the second that time clock starts with this capital that's going to allow you to take the steps towards phase four? We're not expecting it all to happen in a day, right? And it's much more exciting and comfortable to partner with people who appreciate that this is a long journey, but I know what we need to do today to start getting closer to that large goal. Of changing the world.
So it's like telling that beautiful story, but also giving some context and specificity about your plan, how you're thinking in that big picture wise, where do you are today from phase one to two, so on and so forth, to hit that final. It's not just about that final fancy changing the world kind of type of motivation. It's more grandiose as to, okay, how do I hit from this moment to the next milestone? Amazing. Speaking about motivation earlier, Luma, I'm curious, what motivates you today?
What motivates me today is, I mean, I think there are a few different ways to think about that. There's, in my work, what motivates me is learning new things. And I think this goes back to, when I left residency, it was this, I really appreciate this advice I got from one of my mentors, Bill Moria at Refactor Capital. He said, as you're moving into this world of venture or of biotech, and you're moving into a new role, you do want to have one foot in a world and understanding that you know, and leave one foot free to explore. And
so beautiful.
I've come to appreciate that with every phase of my career, I've been able to grow the side that is things that I know, right? It's I understood lipid metabolism, and then I understood how to practice medicine and where limitations are there. And then I understood what value means in the context of technology commercialization. I understood what it meant to be an investor and how to do that as well as I could. And it's that foot that's exploring that I get really excited about. And when I can be in a place where I'm allowed to share experience that I know that's going to help something grow and build, but I can also learn something new in that same role, I get really, really excited. And that's
beautiful.
That's necessary to build, right? I mean, that's growth.
That's beautiful said. That's path dependency, right? We're always taking one step at a time and moving forward.
Yes. Yes.
What do you think is your superpower, Rima?
Oof. That's a great question, and tough for someone who doesn't like talking about herself that much.
There's so many to choose from.
That's kind. What I can say is something that I get energy from that I think others don't. Is understanding interpersonal relationships in the context of motivation. And this is something that we touched on earlier, but this idea of how, when you think about an organization, when you're a small company, and I give this a lot of different contexts of this, but I'll give the context of a startup because it's relevant to the folks listening. When you're, it's you and your co-founder or just you founding a company, the decisions you make directly drive progress of the company. Think about, you know, when you get to Series A, Series B, Series C, I think it's common to think about that in the context of how much money has been raised, where you are in revenue, where you are on actual product development. But the reminder of you also grow in the size of your organization is something that I've noticed doesn't hit founders until it's already happened, where now you have 20 people working under you, you have 40 people, you have 100, 500 people working under you. And your activities, your personal activities, no longer contribute directly to progress of the company. It is the activities of this entire organization of people. An organization is an entity, but it's made up of so many people with different personalities, different motivations, different definitions of success. And as much as you can communicate what success should look like for the organization and match that with the motivation of each individual person, the closer you get to this kind of series of molecules functioning on, you know, entropy-like movements to move in the same direction of organization growth, of company success.
Yeah.
And I'm not, as a superpower, I'm still working on figuring out how to best drive that motivation. But I do get really excited to solve that problem. And it's draining for some, I've learned, right? Like that idea of how do you manage a bunch of people is draining. And I get really excited to work on that problem. And so I think of it as a superpower in that, you know, whatever you choose to dedicate time to is something you'll get better at. And so I think that's something I'm excited to focus more on.
You're just such a people leader. You know, you speak about how you were growing up in a different religion, different context of environment. That's not different than what you are doing today. We're leading a group of smart individuals coming from complete different background, but all geniuses equally. And you as an investor on multiple different board and organization and make sure everyone all moving in the same direction so that we all can hit our goals. We all have that, you know, hitting that KPI, having that success. That's just you. You are the people leader, Rima.
Well, that's a kind way to say it. And anyway, I just hope to keep doing right by the people in my life.
I love that. And Rima, in the beginning, you mentioned about how your father, your parents are from India and grew up in a small town, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I'm curious today, you know, you have a complete different path because of your family, I imagine, compared to your cousin and such. Mm. How do you see American dream?
No, I love that question. And it's, you know, it is, you know, being a the daughter of immigrants. And I've talked to others who are in a similar position about this, where to think about how hard it was for my parents to leave a country that they lived in for their entire life at the age of 30. And just create a new life here in a country where they didn't know the language. And I mean, it's your story, Gwen, too, right? And I've so much respect for how challenging and hard that was. And, you know, I have the fortune of growing up in this country and not having to adapt physically to a new place, right? I know the language. I have an understanding of American culture because I grew up in it. But that drive, and I don't know if it's coming from my parents, from thinking about that story, or if it's genetic or what it is, because of course not everyone chooses to be an immigrant. Again, going back to you, right? Like where most of your people you grew up with stayed in that town. The desire to create something that didn't exist before, I think that's my American dream, right? Where I am so fortunate to have the comfort that my parents created because they decided to be very uncomfortable for a while, define what success looked like for their family, which is two well-educated kids who now have an opportunity to create something of their own, right? And I think it is that creation. And again, it goes back to defining success and what does my success look like if I want to create something that didn't exist before? What are the steps I need to take to get there? I think that's my American dream is creating something that can help the world that wouldn't exist if I wasn't here.
It's so beautiful, Rima. And a lot of people can say that. I want to make a world a better place. But you really not only say that, you do that. You have such a courage in your heart to know exactly who you are, what you want. And every step along the way, even though they are tough choices, you're leaning in, asking that why, and then follow through that breadcrumb until you find that final, like that jackpot, if that's right word to say. I think it's so admirable, and seeing you so relentlessly focusing on your why, which is truly making the world a better place, truly creating that value, creating that impact that I have never seen before, and make the world a little bit different than we're here. And I just seeing your story unfolding in that relentless drive and persistent and just getting it right, it's just really inspiring.
Well, I appreciate it. There's still a lot to do. But all we can do is keep trying.
Until keep last building. Breath on earth, we always keep trying. We always a work in progress, right?
That's right.
But I think when we know the why, when we know who we are, the rest becomes easy. With that, Rima, I want to say, wow, thank you so much for coming on board to share such authentic and beautiful stories. And I'm just so inspired by who you are and example you serve and you become and serving so many amazing technical founders who are in the path looking for the light, looking for a way to changing the world. They can model after you and having your guidance and support. I just think that you are doing amazing things on this planet. So truly well done and thank you.
Thank you so much, Wen, for those kind words and for just inviting me to join this conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
It is an honor. So with that, everybody, I hope you all enjoy today's conversation as much as I do. And I cannot wait to see you all next time. Bye, guys.
Bye.